today on Edinburgh Radio News.
Some people come here and they say, oh, it smells so nice, it's so great for you to work with bars, and I'm like, no, it's not.
We get up early in the morning to take a look into the heart of LA's flower market. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Edinburgh Radio News for Tuesday, March 25th, 2014. I'm Ana Ucar. Young people in Los Angeles will be hard at work this summer, thanks to the creation of 10,000 summer job opportunities. As Alexis Mason reports, Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the initiative this morning at the Yo Watts College Center.
We're here today because there's simply too many kids who need a helping hand.
Mayor Garcetti is talking about underprivileged youth between the ages of 14 and 24, the kids who have the hardest time finding jobs. Disney CEO Robert Iger says Disney Corporation will also play a role.
The Walt Disney Company is very proud to support your efforts with a grant of $1 million to the Summer Youth Program.
Yeah.
Thank you. To create thousands of opportunities for young people to participate in a variety of different activities to support their well-being and gain skills and experience that will prepare them for success in the long term.
Mayor Garcetti ginned up his Hire LA's Youth Initiative because of one economic issue.
Our youth employment rate has actually gone down by about 15 points in the last decade. Los Angeles now has one of the highest youth unemployment rates, I think 98th out of 100 cities.
The 10,000 jobs should improve Los Angeles's ranking, but only temporarily, as these are summer jobs. Catherine Scrivens says Hire LA's youth changed her life.
I was a high school dropout. I didn't plan on going back to school. And this program definitely pushed me and just helped me along the way. And it's so great that the city funds programs like this to help us, because we definitely need it. You know, we are the future.
Summer jobs build experience and a resume, leading to jobs later in life. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, youth who miss out on an early work experience are more likely to endure future unemployment. Alexis Mason, Edinburgh Radio News.
The Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors is pushing for tax incentives to bring film and television production back to South California. Filming has dropped 50% from its peak in 1996. In the last decade, more than $3 billion has been lost in entertainment wages. Production has since moved to places like Georgia, New York, Louisiana, and Canada because they offer tax subsidies to attract filmmakers. The first of several planned memorial services was held today for an icon in the South Los Angeles community. Celis King IV died Saturday of a heart attack. He was 70 years old. Joey Wong reports.
Friends and family gather to memorialize Celis King IV today. Even though some people would confuse him with his father, King's sister Terry says her brother carried on their family's legacy.
I think he had a strong desire to not just step into my father's shoes, because you can't fill someone else's shoes, but he wanted to continue the footsteps. And actually, he succeeded.
He was known as South LA's man in Sacramento. He spent many hours representing his community's views to state legislators. He was mostly concerned with making sure that people have access to healthcare and education. Adrian Dove is chairman of the Congress of Racial Equality, which is also known as CORE. He says King's role in Sacramento was to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. King had many accomplishments in his lifetime, but he was also in the shadow of his father, Celis King III.
People still confuse what was the accomplishments of Celis King III and Celis King IV.
His father started the family bail bond business, founded CORE, and renamed Santa Barbara Boulevard Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. A funeral service will be held this Saturday at 11 a.m. at the Angeles Mesa Presbyterian Church. Joey Wong, Edinburgh Radio News.
Hundreds of foster children as young as 12 years old are sold for sex in LA County each year. The LA County Board of Supervisors is now demanding that foster parents be trained to be alert to possible sex trafficking cases. Michaela Wickham has more on the story.
Los Angeles, along with San Diego and San Francisco, are the top counties with large numbers of children subjected to sex trafficking. Second District County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas says foster children are the most vulnerable.
Those individuals need more help, more care, more attention than would otherwise be the case. And these predators know it. They know how vulnerable they are. They know how susceptible they are. That's what predators do.
Supervisors Mark Ridley Thomas and Don Nabe introduced a motion to require state-licensed foster parents to complete annual training that would make them aware of signs that children under their care are being sexually exploited. Last year, the Department of Children and Family Services received 281 complaints of children being sexually exploited. Xiomara Flores-Holguin is a manager at the Department of Children and Family Services. She says young girls are most vulnerable.
This crossover issue that our children, our girls, are being exploited at such a young age from foster care, from group homes. That's the concern that we have.
Sex trafficking involves gangs forcing children to have sex for money. These foster care children are easy prey to gang members looking to sell them for sex, in part because the foster parents are often unaware of the dangers and uninvolved in the children's lives. I spoke with Asia Brown, mayor of the city of Compton. Brown says one simple element has made a difference in their community.
Locally, we've actually eliminated hourly motel rentals in the city of Compton, which has had an extremely beneficial effect on reducing child sex trafficking within our city.
County organizations such as the Department of Children and Family Services are working with law enforcement to reduce the amount of child sex trafficking. Rachel Thomas, who is a survivor of human trafficking, says spreading awareness can help prevent exploitation.
But if my parents had gone to a community, you know, town meeting, or had heard it on the news, or if they had been educated, then that could have helped me.
The first task is being able to identify characteristics of children who have been sold for sex. Xiomara Flores-Holguin of Children and Family Services says a lack of supervision is one of a few clear signs to look out for.
Tattoos that are quite visible. Are they wearing expensive clothing, expensive accessories? School, is this child going to school?
But because sex traffickers target foster care children even more heavily, by the time officials intervene, it can be too late.
By then, they've been threatened. They've been approached by an individual that's promising them love and protection and safety, and we've lost them.
And the problem is mobile. Pimps move sex trafficking victims out of L.A. County and throughout the entire state. They may even go from L.A. to San Diego and then all the way up to San Francisco. The Department of Children and Family Services is now on the clock for 30 days to tell the Board of Supervisors how costly a plan like this could be. Mykella Wickham, Annenberg Radio News.
A group representing Los Angeles bus riders used some creativity today to call attention to a proposed fare increase. Camila Requesas went to the event today and spoke to some of the participants.
And we're going to stop this unholy alliance against the bus riders.
Now we'll take this.
Members of the Bus Riders Union, a group of students and everyday commuters, met on the corner of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Western Avenue this morning, sporting painted faces and costumes. They were holding signs that read, "Free student bus passes."
And you, fare raiser, you're snatching all of our funds, and we are going to have free public transportation.
Huh?
Yes!
No!
Yes!
No!
Last year, the MTA raised fares by 30%. Over the next 6 years, the MTA could raise fares by as much as 170%. Union member Michelle Lopez is a college student, and she is clearly unhappy.
Tuition and then transportation, that's already an issue to me. And not myself, but like my mom, she's a single mother. So we barely make $14,000 a year. So, you know, that's another burden on in our backs.
The MTA says it has a $36 million operating deficit, and that amount is growing. The MTA also says it must raise fares to pay its debt. In an attempt to offset their financial plan, the MTA says it will give riders a free 90-minute transfer. That means riders getting off one bus have 90 minutes to board another bus for free. Members of the union are still unhappy with this plan and say the MTA has enough funds to pay for operating services without having to increase fares. MTA spokesman Rick Jagger says bus and metro fares cover less than a third of the cost of operations.
Currently, metro fares only cover about 26% of our operating expenses. And that's pretty low. In fact, that's probably one of the lowest percentages of any U.S. major transits here in the nation.
And he says that's low compared to other cities.
What's wrong with championing the lowest fares? And then when you actually look at it, are they really? Because we, like a lot of other cities, pay into our transit system in sales tax, 1.5% sales tax. Other cities don't have that. So if you're going to do the comparison, do it correctly.
But Barbara Lott Holland, co-chair of the Bus Rider Union, says low fares are a good thing. Union members will take their battle to the public hearing on Saturday morning
That's
at the MTA.
Class people of color on those buses who are going to come out and defeat.
Camille Requiestas, Annenberg Radio News.
Some chilly weather ahead tonight and tomorrow, and we might get some rain tomorrow as well. Highs in the mid-60s will continue through Thursday. Later on Annenberg Radio News, if you've ever driven up the I-5 in Central California, you've most likely seen and smelled the Big Cattle Ranch. We'll tell you about its unlikely neighbor. Now we begin a series looking at the people who make Los Angeles run. The night shift workers, the minimum wage employees, and the undocumented laborers. For the first story in the series, Catherine Davis takes us to downtown Los Angeles, where all night long, warehouse workers stay up to keep a global industry going. It's a rough business for a delicate product, flowers.
It's 4:30 in the morning at the LA Flower Market. It's a few hours into a typical workday for Willie Sanchez. He leans back in his chair in front of his stall's counter, snacking on popcorn and coffee. He nods hello to almost everyone who passes. Everyone in the flower market knows Willie Sanchez.
Buenos dias, ¿cómo está?
Sanchez started working in the flower market 50 years ago.
No, I was 16 years old. Work for somebody, push the cars, they have the customers.
Now it's his kids, William and Yvette, who help the customers. Willie could stay home and let his kids run the business, but his son says,
he can't stay away. I tell him, you know, stay home a couple days a week. He can't. He's just so used to it.
The early mornings in the flower market are something his kids have gotten used to, too.
Some people come here and they say, oh, it smells so nice, it's so great for you to work with flowers. And I'm like, no, it's not. It makes you smile a lot, but no, you just get used to it like any other thing.
While Yvette greets customers and rings up their purchases, William checks emails and faxes to see what flower shops are ordering and to correspond with growers to make sure he has enough of each variety to sell to his customers.
William, do you have an extra flower for me?
Only regular gardens.
It's a clash of delicate beauty in an industrial setting. Tight rosebuds packed in cardboard containers, dahlias crowded into heavy-duty plastic buckets, orchid stems held upright with masking tape. Florists stocking up for their retail shops stack big metal carts high with bunches of flowers wrapped in newspaper while William and his employees prepare flowers to be sold. If William can't sell exactly as much as he orders, the flowers will begin to wilt within days.
A lot of the ordering is anticipating that they're going to need the product.
If you order too much, then you might lose all your profit there.
There's little room for error, but William and Yvette are experienced. They've known the flower market all of their lives. But the business they know is different from the business of their father's generation. The flower market's two main warehouse spaces have been near LA's Skid Row since the 1920s, But what was once a place for local farmers to trade with retailers has become the center of a global industry thanks to greenhouse farming, refrigerated shipping, and internet communication.
We have imported from Mexico, Colombia, then we also have locally grown in.
But with modern communication, more florists are able to communicate directly with growers, cutting out middleman wholesalers like the Sanchez family.
And so it's less business for everybody.
And flower sellers also feel the impact of larger economic trends. Even though flower trading in the U.S. is about a $30 billion industry, it's still struggling to get back to pre-recession profits.
The thing is, a lot of people don't really want to spend a lot of their money on their flowers. They think it's more of a luxury than a need. So that's what's hurting a little bit.
But Willie Sanchez has seen it all in his half century in the business.
Well, we're making a living okay, so I'm not worried too much.
And for his family, who have spent most of their lives in the flower market, there's no thought of switching careers.
I started working full-time since I was 18 years old, so it's been 20 years. But my dad needed my help, and that's how I got stuck here. And then my brother got stuck here too, so. I can't imagine myself getting home at 7 o'clock at night. That's like so foreign to me.
By the time most of downtown Los Angeles is taking their lunch break, the flower market is closing up for the day. William said he doesn't know what happens to any of the flowers he sells after they leave his warehouse. He doesn't think about it much. When asked why they enjoy their work, Yvette, William, and Willie all give the same answer. It has nothing to do with the flowers. The idea of selling something beautiful and luxurious doesn't even come up. The reason they give is simply they like working with their family, and the flower market is home.
Bye, have a good day.
Catherine Davis, Annenberg Radio News. Recent data from the Department of Education shows that graduate school loans may be behind America's student debt problem. Christina Savan reports.
I'm going to have to owe so much after this.
I think it's ridiculous.
That really sucks.
Scared shitless.
I just think that it's sad.
There is roughly $1 trillion in student debt, and 40% of that loan number helps pay for expensive graduate and professional degrees. These findings come from New America Foundation, which is an education budget program. Jason Delisle of New America, who published the findings, broke down how grad students are paying more than ever before.
A Master of Arts of students who borrow at the median, in 2004, they left school with combined undergrad and grad debt of about $40,000. In 2012, after adjusting for inflation, that number's about $59,000.
Delisle says that in 2006, grad students were only able to borrow $20,000 from the federal government.
And then in 2006, they changed the policy such that grad students could borrow whatever the school charges. I don't think it's a coincidence that shortly after that policy is in effect is where we see a really big uptick in debt levels.
Delisle's advice to grad students is that before you borrow money, go ahead and make sure that you know your monthly payment options for once you're out of school. However, he says that these findings really illustrate a much larger public policy issue on whether or not the federal government should be giving out large loans to people in graduate school when many low-income families are still unable to receive an undergraduate education. Christina Savan, Annenberg Radio News.
The deadline to enroll in Covered California is less than a week away. While many people are still trying to make sense of all the different options available, researchers at USC found that 42% of Americans can't even explain what a deductible is. To find out more on this, I asked Professor Sylvia Barcelos what she found to be the biggest misunderstanding.
Well, it's hard to say what the biggest misunderstanding is, but we definitely see that when we collected the data, which was 5 weeks before the opening enrollment period, we found that a lot, like half of the sample, just did not know that the exchanges existed. And that number was even higher for poor respondents and uninsured respondents, which are exactly the populations that are targeted by the ACA. They are expected to enroll using these exchanges.
Where's the disconnect? Why aren't people understanding? I mean, me personally, I have to admit, I myself don't understand a lot of the information that goes behind healthcare. But what do you think it is that's, you know, maybe the government is doing wrong and trying to explain the options? I mean, what is it?
No, I don't think that that's a good question. I think what's important to note is that what the ACA and these health insurance exchanges do is that they kind of change the context. In other words, if you thought, you know, a few years ago, most people who were choosing health insurance, they were choosing health insurance through their employer, and the employer pre-screened a number of health insurance options, and they just offered employees, say, two or three options. So now what the exchanges do is that they shift the responsibility to individuals to purchase health insurance. And therefore, now individuals must go on these exchanges and choose among dozens, sometimes hundreds of different plans.
That was Sylvia Barcelos, lead author of a study conducted by USC's Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics and the Dornsife Center for Economic and Social Research. Every church faces challenges. For Hindus in Central California, that means a small congregation and challenging surroundings. Arts and Culture producer Graham Clark reports from Fresno.
Cows. Thousands of them. This is Harris Ranch, the largest cattle slaughterhouse on the west coast of the United States. It's so huge they built a hotel on site where you can have fresh seared steaks delivered as breakfast in bed. Head a few miles east, and the smell of raw fertilizer begins to fade. The moos, brays, cud chewing, and serrated knives get drowned out by a different sound altogether. The man doing all that chanting is
Swami Nikhilanand, and we are in the Hindu temple of Fresno, California.
Here, smack dab in the middle of the state's $2 billion cattle industry, lies the Hindu temple of Fresno. It actually shares an area code with Harris Ranch. This Hare Krishna community is the only place of worship for Hindus in Central California. That geography matters because, as priest Pandit Martin Sharma can explain,
We worship the cows. If you can worship of the cow, you worship every god. We don't have any Hindu temple, at least 100 miles radius.
Not only does killing cows go against Hindu principles, the religion opposes all kinds of meat consumption. Here's Adrishananda, Swamiji of the Pasadena Hindu Temple, the bureaucratic head of Hinduism for all of California.
The Hindu religion practice vegetarian food. No animal product. No killing.
Beef is only the most obvious issue dividing this community from its surroundings.
It's just the difference in two cultures, in a way. You know, Western culture is very invested in the meat industry. In fact, the meat and alcohol industries.
That's Rochelle Jarrell, who converted to Hinduism in college more than 15 years ago.
Once families leave India and come west, that a lot of families lose the connection to their values or they become more westernized. And if they can keep their kids close to the principle, it will help preserve the family lineages and the Dharma.
Monica Joshi volunteers at the temple, makes her living practicing Ayurvedic medicine, and has beef with the meat industry.
Not even if you didn't look at it from Hindu perspective about cows, if you look at just from health perspective, eating the meat and other products that are coming from the cows that are treated with antibiotics and hormones, and they're treated in such a bad in condition, especially here in Central Valley.
Monica names her temple as the first place she felt spiritual belonging and like-minded community. Now her whole family comes together here. Her children even lead aarti, a ritual built on traditional Hindu melodies.
My name is Krishan Joshi, and I'm 13 years old. The harmonium is the instrument that I played.
I'm Shriya, and I was drumming. But this kind of drumming I've been doing since third grade, I think.
It's really nice helping everybody do their devotion towards God.
Worshippers see the temple as a rare outpost of support for values, traditions, and beliefs beyond the pale of mainstream America.
This temple is sort of kind of like my second home, almost. Here I can actually, like, be comfortable about it, because when I do it somewhere else, people stop and stare at me.
The Hindu temple of Fresno is small,
It is unique because we're a very small town, considering we don't have that many Hindu families. So I joke with people that, you know, we're in a small village, so we have a really small village temple.
The week's most popular services average a turnout in the low 40s. That puts it in a place of dubious sustainability, finance-wise.
Between air conditioning and landscape and meals and food and maintenance of the place and whatnot, you know, it takes a lot of effort. So challenges are to encourage people to come in and donate. And, you know, that's usually a challenge I suppose every organization goes through.
If this temple weren't here, I don't really know what would happen. I can't really imagine it because it has impacted me that much.
Even though Hinduism can be practiced without a public place of worship, nothing could come close to replacing this community amongst the cows. Graham Clark, Edinburgh Radio News.
Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
My family, there were 13 of us in the family, and we used to come to Alvarez Street every Sunday.
It's very much like Mexico. It's a lot of the kiosks and stores are very, very similar.
Is Los Angeles giving too much money to fat cat Wall Street bankers? According to some protesters in downtown LA, the answer is yes. Sean Birch has more.
Fix our streets! Don't run Wall Street!
Demonstrators held signs that said, "Fix our streets, not Wall Street," this morning in the financial district of downtown LA. The Fix LA Coalition wants the city to spend less on bank fees and more on rebuilding Los Angeles. According to a study by the group, the city spent more than $200 million last year for financial fees and high interest rates. For comparison, LA only spent $163 million on street services. Bahar Talu, a research analyst for the Service Employees International Union, says this is unacceptable.
This is important because today we have a new report that details that there's $200 million going to Wall Street just last year. This is just a huge amount of money that is draining our budgets. It's making investment in public services more expensive, and it's reducing returns for investors. This doesn't make sense when we don't have money for public services.
Les Leopold, the executive director of the Labor Institute, says Los Angeles has the ability to escape the predatory fees.
They should negotiate a much harder bargain. LA has $100 billion plus in bonds, cash, liquid assets, and the banks are dying to get their hands on that money. That gives them a great deal of leverage to negotiate better fees.
Richard Guzman, a sanitation worker for LA, says the lack of cash has left the city in shambles.
The streets, the sidewalks aren't being fixed, aren't being replaced, potholes aren't being replaced, tree trims. I mean, I heard that it takes, if you call in from your residence that you need a tree trimmed, it takes, you're on a list for 7 years, and that's ridiculous. That is ridiculous.
As revenues decline, the city is relying more heavily on property taxes to cover the cost of city services. Sean Birch, Annenberg Radio News.
Now we check in with Ben Capinos to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Hey, Ben.
Hey, well, we have the latest on the missing Malaysia Airlines flight. We also have details on the university's new amnesty policy for reporting sexual assaults. Find out how students can report these crimes without getting in trouble tonight on ATVN.
Looking forward to it. We definitely will tune in. Thanks so much, Ben. If you're a fan of giant birds that eat the dead, you should check out the Department of Wildlife's Condor Cam, which live streamed today's release of four California condors. The four birds have been in captivity since birth and can be spied on 24/7 at the Oakland Zoo's website, if you're into that kind of thing. That's it for this Tuesday. We had help today from ATVN and Kylie Morgan. Our production assistant is Lexi McAvinci. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, and the newscast producer is Andy Vasoyan. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis, and for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ani Ukar.